Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of Valley Grove Baptist Church. We are thankful you stopped by to hear from God's Word, to grow closer to Him, and to be inspired to reach your area of influence. All right, if you've got your Bibles this morning, let's find Revelation chapter 5. Revelation chapter 5, that's where we're going to land this morning. We'll be looking at the entire chapter as it continues where we left off a couple weeks ago. As a way of reminder, 2 weeks ago we kind of moved into the second section of Revelation, which as we said then is much more apocalyptic in nature, and so has some visions and scenes and number emphasis and all of this kind of stuff. And so John opens this second section by saying that he hears a voice calling him up to heaven that says, we're going to show you what must happen next. And so you would expect some timeline and chronology of how the world's going to end. But what happens next is John sees this glorious, multicolored, prismatic image of God on the throne and these 24 elders and four living creatures, and worship upon worship upon worship is going on. And we ask the question, because in that scene we see God the Father and the Holy Spirit, and we ask the question, where is Jesus at? Well, today we're going to meet Jesus, because as soon as John is taken in this as much as he can, this amazing scene, John sees something, in that what he sees is kind of the impetus for us to meet Jesus in this heaven scene as John opens his second section. So here's what we're going to do. We'll read the first four verses, and then we'll come back and talk about them. So we'll read 1, 2, 3, 4, then we'll come back to 1, and we'll walk through them, and then we'll kind of read the next section and go from there. All right, here we go. Verses 1 through 4, Revelation chapter 5. Then I, that's John, saw in the right hand of him who was seated on the throne a scroll written within and on the back, sealed with seven seals. Verse 2. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming with a loud voice, "Who is worthy to open the scroll and to break its seals?" And no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or to look in it. And John began to weep loudly because no one was found worthy to open the scroll or to look into it. All right, so let's go back to verse number 1. All right, so as John is taking in this glorious image of heaven, of God seated on the throne, what he notices is that God seated on the throne has something in his hand. So as he's looking at this great image, taking in, he focuses on the one seated on the throne, God the Father, and he sees that he has a scroll in his right hand. And he notes that there's a couple things about that scroll. First, he notes that it has writing on the inside and on the outside, and it is sealed with seven seals. So let's talk about scrolls just for a minute, because this is going to be important for how the action in the story goes next. All right, so scrolls in the ancient world. Scrolls in the ancient world were at this point made of, really, by and large, made of papyrus. Now, papyrus is basically, if you're not familiar with it, it is a plant that grows along the banks of rivers. And actually, believe it or not, if you go to Columbus and you go to Chef Lee's, number 2, in Columbus, by their koi ponds, they actually have papyrus growing. Because I noticed the other day, leaves, spiky leaves that grow out like this. And it has a stem, a spike that goes straight up, and it has like a five-fingered frond thing at the top, right? And so it was prolific in Egypt. In fact, Egypt was like the world leader in papyrus during the ancient world. And what you do with the papyrus is you cut that stalk off and you basically soak it in water and you smash it. And they had these big rocks that they would roll, and you smash it flat, and then you take papyrus and lay it this way, and then you take papyrus and lay it this way, and then you take bigger stones and you literally press it together, and such that the cellulose breaks and literally forms glue, so it glues it together. And then if you were really like highfalutin, they would take and they would sand it with like sandpaper so that it would almost be like our paper today. I've actually got a little square of papyrus, and it is amazingly, I mean, you can tell it has some ridges in it, but it is, for the ancient world, amazingly smooth, right? And so that's what most of the scrolls were written on. And most of the scrolls in this setting would have been rolled up, right? And so for the fact that John says there's writing on the inside and the outside shows that this is a full and complete message or whatever's in the scroll, right? Now we, at this point, we don't know what's in the scroll, but we understand that writing on both sides shows that this is a full and complete message, because most of the time, you would only write on the side with the lines going this way. Right? That makes sense, right? That's, you know, the paper we use has the lines going this way, right? Because, you know, when you're young, it helps you figure out where to put the letters, and then you just kind of keep using it because we write this way. So most letters, even if you were writing your grocery list, there was a huge cache of papyrus found in Egypt years and years ago at a place called Oxyrhynchus. You don't have to worry about that, but anyway. And they found everything from your grocery list to letters to some other religious texts and all of this. So literally, even your grocery list, you would write with the side going this way. Rarely did people write on the side going this way. And so you would write on the inside and you would roll it up, right? And that makes sure the ink, it stays where it needs to stay, because if there's writing on the outside and gummy hands get on it, what happens? It wears it off. But here John is very specific, because he said there's writing on within and on the back. So what this is it's God's complete message to somebody. It's a complete revealing, no pun intended, or a complete letter of some kind to somebody. Okay. Now, he also says that it's sealed seven seals. Now, this is interesting, because normally what would happen is you would seal it with one seal. And the way seals worked is you would write on the inside with lines going this way, and then you would roll it up, and then you would tie a string. You'd put a string around it and tie it in a bow, and then you would take wax, and you would pour the wax over the knot, and then every, you know, person had a ring that had like their seal. It was called a signet ring. And they would take that ring and they would press it in that wax, and then it would dry with that seal, knowing the letter was from this person, and that as long as that seal was intact, you knew nobody had tampered with the message, right? It's kind of like if I mail you a letter and I get the letter and it's, you know, not licked, and or however you do it, you know, you've got, now they've got the little cool little, like, you tear off the little thing and stick it, right? If you get a letter in the mail and that's broken, what do you know? Somebody read your letter, right? So this was the ancient world's version. They would pour wax, push the ring in it, and that seal, which was unique to the sender, would know, so the receiver knew, hey, this person sent me this letter and nobody's messed with it, right? But this one doesn't just have one. It has how many? Seven, right? Which is also the sign, the numbers, the number seven equals perfection, completeness, divinity. So what do we have here? Yes, literally it has seven seals, but what the image is portraying is that God has a message for somebody. Now, we don't know who it is yet. God has a message for somebody that is of divine nature, that is perfect, that is complete, right? So the scroll has writing on the inside and on the outside, sealed with seven seals. The seals are unbroken, meaning that it is God's message to somebody. It is divine, holy, perfect, and totally complete. The question then is, who's the message for? Like, who's the letter to? Like, God is the sender. Who's the receiver of the message? Well, verse 2 says that a mighty angel asked the question, right? Because you got a scroll. It's complete. It's perfect. Inside, outside writing. Sealed with seven seals. Divine in nature. It's God's message to somebody. So the next question is, hey, who's this letter to? And so this angel says in a loud voice, hey, who is worthy to open the scrolls? And what happens? Verse 3, crickets. Chirp, 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 chirp. Dead silence. Because remember, all right, now go from chapter 4. What happens in chapter 4? Worship and praise, and over the 24 elders and the living creatures are giving praise to God. And then at some point, that kind of stops, and John notices the scroll, and then an angel says, "Who is worthy to open the scroll?" And then it's like, whoop, dead silence, right? And so John, you imagine John, I mean, hey, I just know if I'm John, I'm like, oh man, it's about to get good up in here. And then John goes on to say in verse 4, I began to weep because no one was found worthy. Nobody in heaven, on earth, or under the earth, like in the abode of the dead. So nobody living or dead or heavenly being is worthy to open the scroll. And so what does John do? He weeps. The word he uses for weep here is the most extreme and extravagant form of crying in the Greek world. So he's not just going, he is like wailing. Have you ever seen the processions? And it really occurs in the Middle East, like when somebody dies and there's all the professional wailers. Like that's the image. Like he's not just sad and downcast. Like he's falling on the ground just beside himself because like he got called up to heaven to see this great thing, and now it's all going to end because like nobody can do this thing, right? Now, verse 5. And one of the elders, so one of those 24 elders, sees John weeping and wailing and comes to him and says, hey, weep no more. And otherwise, hey, dude, stop your crying. Because, behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, now we're going to read verse 5, stay here a minute. The Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered, and he can open the scroll and its seven seals. So, oh man. So amidst John's extreme crying, one of the elders comes down and says, hey bud, don't worry about it. Get up. Fix your face. Like, look here. There is somebody who can open this seal. And it is none other than the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David. All right, so let's talk about these. Both of these descriptors have Old Testament references. So the first one, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, just in, if you're ever doing Bible trivia and you wondered what was the fourth most mentioned animal in the Bible, it's the lion. Just in case you wanted to know that. I thought that was pretty cool. The most referenced animal in the Bible is the one we'll see next in verse number 6, the lamb or the sheep. But anyway, fourth most is the lion. Right, and in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, the lion always symbols power and authority, strength. And in Genesis 49:9-10, here's what Jacob says to his son Judah. Judah, he gives a blessing to all of his children. Here's what he says to Judah. Judah is a lion's cub from the prey. My son, you have gone up. He stooped down. He crouched as a lion and as a lioness, who dares rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. In other words, let me just put it in Old Testament context. Jacob is telling Judah right then, your people, your descendants will be like lions. They will be powerful, authoritative, and strong, and they will be rulers over the people. And guess what happens? That totally comes true. With who? David. Right? David. David is of the tribe of Judah. And God makes a covenant with David and says that from David, all the kings will come. And what happens in the Old Testament? Every king of Judah, well, for David and Solomon, it's king of Israel, Judah and Israel, all the tribes. But then after that, there's the kingdom of Israel, the northern ones, and then Judah. And every king is a direct descendant of David. And so by the elder saying that the one who can open the scroll is the Lion of the tribe of Judah. In other words, he's saying he is the most powerful. He is the of this tribe, of this people that have authority and have kingly nature and royal blood. He is more authoritative and more powerful than all of them. And then he brings David into the mix. And he says, he's the root of David. This comes from Isaiah. And so when you put these two together, what you have here is the elder is saying, the one who can open the seals and read the scroll, whom the message from God is intended to. He is one that is powerful, authoritative, and royal, and kingly in nature. And he is so because look what he says. He has conquered. Look at the verb. Look at it. Has conquered. Not will conquer. Not is conquering. Has conquered. What's that? Past tense. In other words, the angel is saying, the Lion of the tribe of Judah and the root of David, he is those things because he has already conquered. He has already won the victory. So let's just be clear. He's describing Jesus in this moment, right? In magnificent and a powerful and authoritative and mighty words, he is describing Jesus. And he's saying, because he has already won the victory, he is the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David. And therefore, he is worthy to open the scrolls. All right, verse 6. Now, before we read verse 6, I want you to get the picture, okay? Get it in your mind. Follow with me. In chapter 4, John sees this glorious, we'll start over here. So John sees this glorious picture of heaven, right? Multicolored, prismatic colors everywhere. God is seated on the throne. Worship. Then at the beginning of chapter 5, he notices this thing in God's right hand, this scroll. And so he notices it, writing on the inside, outside, seven seals. And then an angel says, who can open the scroll? And there's dead silence, right? So the image is that John's over here, and he's looking at the throne, right? And he sees the thing in God's right hand. And then the angel says, hey, who can open it, right? And then one of the 24 elders comes and is talking to John. And so John's like facing that dude, right? They're having an interaction together. And how does the elder describe the person who can open the scroll? Lion, root of David. What did we just say those were? Strong, authoritative, powerful. Right? Now, look at verse. And between the thrones. So John turns back to see this Lion of the tribe of Judah, right? Power, strength. And what does he see? And between the throne and the four living creatures and among the elders, I saw a, what's the next word? The lion. Lamb. I saw a lamb standing, but as though it had been slain, with seven horns and with seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out in all the earth. Now, what a juxtaposition. Just one verse earlier, the elder says to him, hey, the lion can open the scroll. But he doesn't see a lion. What does he see? A lamb, not just a lamb, but a lamb standing as though it had been murdered, killed, crushed, bloodied, beaten. What a juxtaposition of the two. Right? And so, I don't think we can walk away, nor do I think we should, without asking this question. What are we to make of this? What are we to make of this? When I was a kid, I should have got the picture up on the screen so you could see it. When I was a kid, but I looked up, you can still go buy one. I had this t-shirt. It was a white t-shirt. And it said it was a Christian spinoff of the Gold's Gym t-shirt. You remember Gold's Gym? It's a Gold's Gym, and it had this like weightlifter dude in the middle. All right. So this t-shirt was a Christian riff off of that, and it said Lord's Gym. All right. And it had Jesus like bench pressing the cross. And it said bench press this. Right? It was cool. I wore it all the time, right? I think it eventually turned into a work, like a you know, oil rag or anyway. But I wore the shirt all the time. It was like, Jesus is like jacked. I mean, he is like, you know. And so as a kid, in my mind, that was Jesus. Like, Jesus was some mix of that t-shirt and Rambo. You know, he was like taking on hell with the machine gun. You know, like Rambo does in First Blood Part 2 when he goes into the, after he's rescued the guy from the commies. Y'all remember that scene? And he takes the machine gun off the helicopter and he goes in the office and shoots all the computers. Like, that was, we watched that over and over and over. Because it was one of the few videos that we had on, like, my dad had recorded, right? That and Top Gun and Rocky IV. Those were the three, right? And so my vision of Jesus was like this jack dude who was taking on, like, you know, taking on hell like Rambo took on the commies. We get to this passage, and it's like, but my whole worldview of Jesus is, like, thrown out the window, right? Because John says he hears the elder say that the lion can open the seal, but he doesn't see the lion. He sees a lamb as though it had been slain. And so we come back to the question, what are we to make of this? And I think what we're to make of this is this passage forces us to hold two realities about Jesus equal in equal measure at the same time. Put it this way, here are the two realities. Jesus is powerful and mighty, but he is so because he is the lamb who was slain. Or to say it this way, Jesus is the lion because he was also the lamb. Or to say it another way, he conquered there because, he has conquered because he was slain. In other words, the lion and lamb image forces us to view Jesus not just as the dude who combats hell like Rambo would, but it forces us to see that Jesus' death on the cross and his willing shedding of his own blood is what gives him the authority and power and might to be this lion image. In other words, we've got to hold both of these realities in check and realize that it is because he, listen, has already conquered that he is willing and able and has the ability to take this message that God has. Right? So let's read all of verse 6 and we'll keep going. And between the throne and the four living creatures and among the elders, I saw a lamb standing as though it had been slain with seven horns and with seven eyes and with seven spirits that God sent out through all the earth. All right, verse 7. And he went and took the scroll from the right hand of him who was seated on the throne. This is kind of the high water mark of this kind of image, this kind of chapter 5 scene, is that Jesus is taking God's message, right? And in the next chapter, we see he's going to start opening and breaking the seals. And in other words, as one of my professors in seminary said, this is the precise meaning. verse 7, this is the precise meaning of Revelation 1:1, the revelation of Jesus Christ which God gave him. In other words, this scroll holds the prophecies of Revelation that John is going to see and to write about. And Jesus is the one who has the ability to open it and reveal it to everybody. This is the whole reason John gets called up into heaven, is to hear and to see what's going to happen in this thing when Jesus opens this scroll. Verse 8. Now, at the moment that Jesus takes the scroll, here's what happens. And when he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, each holding a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. Verse 9. And then they sang a new song, saying, "Worthy are you to take the scroll and to open its seals. For you were slain, and by your blood you were ransomed. You ransomed people for God from every tribe, language, and people, and nation." Verse 10. "And you have made them a kingdom and priests to our God, and they shall reign on the earth." Verse 11. "Then I looked, and I heard around the throne the living creatures and the elders and the voice of many angels, numbering myriads of myriads and thousands of thousands." Verse 12. "Saying with a loud voice, 'Worthy is the Lamb who was slain, to receive power and wealth and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing. Verse 13. And I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and in heaven and in the sea, and all that is in them, saying, to him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be blessing and honor and glory and might forever and ever. Verse 14, last one. And the four living creatures said, amen. And the elders fell down and worshiped. So what happens when Jesus, the Lamb, who is the Lion, the Lion who is the Lamb, takes the scroll in his hand? What happens? Immediate and overwhelming worship breaks out. Now, I want you to look at how it grows. So, first, the worship starts with that heavenly court of the 24 elders and four living creatures. And they begin to worship, right? Then the group grows to, John says, a myriad of myriad, thousands of thousands of angels. And that's that thousand is like the biggest word they had to describe a number in Greek. You know, like we have billion and trillion. They didn't have all those words. In other words, what John is saying is, with an uncountable number of angels begin to join in this worship of Jesus. And then it gets one step bigger. So you got 24 elders, four living creatures, an uncountable number of just angels. And then the group gets even bigger, because it says basically every creature across the earth, like not just people, creature, even the fire ants and the mosquitoes, right? And the gnats and the no-see-ums and the deer and the buffalo and the dogs and the cats all worship Jesus. Now, what do they say? In essence, if we were to take all of these together, they collectively voice one message. The Lamb is worthy to take and open the scroll. Why? Because he willingly gave his life. Here's the line they say in the song. He ransomed people. In other words, he bought back people for God from every tribe, every language, every people, and every nation. In other words, Jesus' death on the cross was the covering and cleansing of sin that gives him the right to take the scroll, open it, and read it. Thus he is worthy of power and wealth and wisdom and might and honor and glory, blessing and honor and might, as they say in their collective things. So, that's the scene. John starts out in chapter 4 with vision of God on his throne and prismatic colors everywhere and worship. Then there's this moment of uncertainty of, oh no, what's going to happen? Because we've got this scroll and it's God, clearly it's God's message that we need to hear, but nobody can open it. Then an elder says, hey, the Lion's going to open it. He's worthy. But then John sees the Lamb, which caught Lamb as though it had been slain, causing us to hold this duality about Jesus, that he is both Lion and Lamb, and that it is because of what he has done on the cross, ransoming people back to God, that he is worthy to open the scroll. And when he takes the scroll, worship, unending worship, happens. Now, what's in the scroll? What is God's message that Jesus is going to reveal about what must happen next? Well, you're going to have to come back to hear that part, because that's what starts happening in chapter 6. All right, now, before we get away today, before you go to lunch, here's what we need to do. We need to ask ourselves a big question. How do we need to work out this passage in our own lives? Because it's a grand scene. And, you know, lately I haven't been caught up to heaven. And, you know, so like, how do we make this passage applicable to our own lives? I want to give you a few ideas before we get out of here this number. Number one, here's what we need to learn. Jesus' death and resurrection are the high point of God's redemptive plan. Listen to me, not the end of the world. Right? The high point of history is the Easter weekend, the death and resurrection of Jesus. That's the apex of the story, the climax of the story. Everything else is building up to that moment, and history now is falling away from it. Yes, the world coming to an end and us going to heaven, if we don't go to the Lord before the end of the world, that's going to be a huge moment. But that's not the apex of history. The apex of history is the cross and the resurrection. So that needs to clarify, but you know, that's clarifying for us in a lot of ways. All right, number two. Jesus is, again, both lion and lamb, not one or the other, but in equal measure. Because here's the reality. Most of us gravitate toward one of those images or the other. Right? Come on. You should know you by now. You gravitate toward one of those images of Jesus more than the other. But the reality is you need both. Because that's who Jesus is. He is both the lion and the lamb, not one or the other. Number three, Jesus is worthy of our worship. If in heaven every creature and every being is worshiping Jesus, it's a good idea for us to start today. And then I want to leave you with this one thought that's maybe kind of the challenge for the week. And I thought about this. This one hit me this week. Like, I had to do some prayers of repentance after I type. You know, it's kind of interesting how the Lord works. You know, when you're preparing a sermon, you're kind of, you know, the way I work it out is I kind of do some handwriting of some notes, and then I take those notes and I write out my sermon. And so kind of, I don't like to say everything that is in my notes that I write out, type out. But you get to a point when sometimes you type out some lines, you're like, ooh, that's a good line. Like, that's a good word. And then it's like, oh, that's a good word for me. Like, oh, this isn't how this works, Lord. And it's like, yeah, no, it is, right? And so here's kind of the rubber meets the road point is, since Jesus has already won the victory, we win through resting in his already won victory, not trying to refight the battle all over again. Right? Because, I mean, let's be real. Again, you know which image you gravitate toward. I gravitate toward the Rambo Jesus. You know, the Jesus pushing up the cross, like the lion image. Like, I gravitate toward that side. And so there's a lot of times in my life where some people just need a good throat punch. Ha-cha. All right, this I've... Sometimes people just, some folks just need a good throat punch. For those of you who didn't laugh, you can laugh later in the car because you know it's true. Sometimes some folks in your life, you want Jesus to be the lion and to go, pa-ya! And sometimes people need two, right? But in those moments, what are we doing? We are trying to fight the battle that Jesus has already won. Right? Like, he's already been victorious, not only over our sin, but over the sins that are done to us. And as much as our emotional response, as much as my emotional response is that sometimes somebody just needs a good throat punch, just light tap, you know. That is me trying to fight a battle that's already been won. And in those moments, what I need to remember and what I need to rest in is that Jesus has already won this battle, and I just need to let him take care of it. Right? And that's tough. And it's hard. And it is not my go-to. Trust me. But all of us, at some points in life, are going to walk through moments where we want to rouse up and we about to ready to go to war. As they said when I was growing up, some of us really want to run toward hell with a water pistol. But the reality is that's futile because Jesus has already conquered death, hell, and the grave. And the rest of Revelation, listen to me, I'm just going to give you a freebie. The rest of Revelation is Jesus working out his already won victory on the world. That's really the rest of the book in a nutshell. Now, I want you to come back because there's more in the nutshell than just that. Like, so keep coming. Like, we've got to work this thing out together, right? And you know, by in the fall, we'll have it all figured out, right? But today, the challenge is we need to rest in Jesus' already won victory this week.
Thanks for listening. For more information about Valley Grove, visit our Facebook page or website, valleygrovechurch.org.